Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Right now, there are seven, that's right, seven offshore wind turbines operating in the United States. But that's going to change soon, especially for folks on and around Martha's Vineyard, where 62 turbines will be built as part of Vineyard Wind, the first commercial-sized offshore wind project in the country. That project received approval from the Biden administration back in May. So it's coming, and we wanted to take some time to talk about this brand new industry, what it means for Massachusetts, what it means for the country. Here to help us do that is New Hampshire Public Radio's climate, energy, and environment reporter and co-host of NHPR's Windfall podcast, Annie Ropick. Annie, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So as any good Massachusetts resident knows, Annie, the seacoast of New Hampshire is a relatively small area compared to neighboring Maine or Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. But you picked wind. Why this NHPR podcast now? Is it about the potential of the industry or what a big deal this is going to be?
Yeah, it's about both. I mean, this really is a moment for the offshore wind industry in the U.S., kind of the moment when the stars have finally aligned and this industry is ready to launch, especially on the East Coast, as you mentioned, and, you know, maybe even in states like New Hampshire with our little coastline up in the Gulf of Maine, all the way down, you know, Virginia, the Mid-Atlantic, and soon potentially off the California coast, the Gulf Coast. You know, the Biden administration is really centering offshore wind in their climate and energy policies as a huge potential source of renewable energy. And so we wanted to look in this moment at what that means for coastal states, for racial equity, like you mentioned, sort of economic equality in this country, and just like what it looks like when an industry is born out of nothing in a country like this, you know, in the era of climate change.
All right. And I want to hear some of what you learned. But Annie Ropick, I want to take just a second to address your co-host, Sam Evans-Brown. We take our journalistic responsibility seriously. I know you do, too. Sam Evans-Brown co-hosted Windfall, but has since left NHPR to work as a clean energy advocate, specifically in support of offshore wind. So in your reporting, how did you deal with his departure editorially to ensure that the reporting didn't contain any biases?
Yeah, we appreciate the chance to address this. So the reason that I am involved in this project is because really just at the very end of the reporting and writing and editing process, this opportunity came up for Sam, who was the founding host of Outside In, which is the podcast that is leading this Windfall series. And like you said, Sam is already now being a clean energy advocate, and that purview includes offshore wind in this region for sure. So we brought me in as an extra set of eyes on the show, an extra editor and a co-host to make sure that the thing was airtight, you know, that there was no bias creeping in. We've had a huge team editing this, and we hired an outside fact checker as well, and just wanted to bring an extra set of journalistic eyes to it. We also made sure that Sam's new job didn't overlap at all with his work on the show, and, you know, he hasn't had editorial input since he began the new job. And, you know, we think it's an important enough topic to not just scrap the show over something like this, and we want people to hear it and decide for themselves.
All right. So in your learning, we often hear offshore wind talked about as a big part of an environmentally friendly future. Why is that? Is it as simple as wind is renewable, or is there more to it?
So it's renewable at huge scale, I think, is the key. You know, if you compare the sort of amount of effort and the space and the money that it takes to build, you know, a solar farm that can produce the same amount of power as wind, just for example, you're getting a lot more bang for your buck with a wind farm. You can produce the same amount of power on the order of like a nuclear power plant, or the amount of wind that's in the pipeline for the East Coast right now. Another way of looking at this is enough to power two New York cities. So when you think about it on those scales, that's really a game changer for the renewable energy industry, which until now has been, you know, a percent here and there. And wind really has the potential to take a huge chunk out of the carbon emissions that we need to reduce in order to address climate change. And it could take a chunk out of it really quickly.
So let's talk about this huge scale thing. I know we only have a handful of turbines in the U.S. In Europe, for example, there are thousands. How far behind is the country compared to the rest of the world?
We're completely behind. Like you said, only seven turbines. Five of those are in Rhode Island. Two are in Virginia. and they're all in state waters. So we're at the beginning of the really the full scale, the utility scale industry here in the States. And a lot of that is down to the sort of false start that was the Cape Wind project that a lot of your listeners are probably familiar with, which was also off of Cape Cod and sort of took 16 years to die a slow death and really taught the government, you know, the wind industry a lot of lessons about how not to do this. And we're seeing those applied to now projects like Vineyard Wind that's really moving forward quickly. And like I said, there are in, you know, every day more projects in the pipeline behind it waiting for approval, waiting to be built. And the Biden administration wants to see pretty much the same amount of wind as there is everywhere else in the world in U.S. waters by 2030.
So in our last minute or so, you talked about the lessons of Cape Wind. Obviously, the general position has changed because Vineyard Wind is happening, but there is still opposition. In Maine, for example, they recently banned offshore wind projects from state waters to help protect the commercial fishing industry. So where is the pushback today to wind, and what do you expect from that?
Yeah, the pushback from the fishing industry is huge, and that is still an ongoing debate, like you mentioned, in Maine and in states like New Hampshire, down to Vineyard Wind in Massachusetts. We spent a whole episode looking at the effect on the squid fishery in Rhode Island, where Vineyard Wind is just about as close to Rhode Island as it is to Massachusetts. It's a pretty unsolved question. In Europe, a lot of those projects just buy out the fishing industries that will be affected and don't allow fishing where the projects are built. So it's a little untested. There hasn't actually been as much research as you'd think on what wind turbines actually mean for fisheries, and the devil is in the details with how they're built, how the fishing works in the same place. So, you know, we're going to have to find out as the industry moves forward, and it's definitely something we're going to hear a lot about in the Northeast.
All right, Annie Ropeek, NHPR climate, energy, and environment reporter and co-host of The Windfall podcast. It was a fascinating podcast, Annie. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
So I want to bring in an additional voice now to help us figure out what this all means for the Commonwealth specifically. We have Elizabeth Turnbull-Henry, president of the Environmental League of Massachusetts. Elizabeth, I know you're on vacation in a remote location and we might have some lag, but I appreciate you taking time out for us. Welcome.
Hi, Tiziana. Thank you for having me.
All right, so we know Vineyard Wind is making its way forward. It got approval from the Biden administration in May. 62 turbines, first commercial scale project in the U.S. With that in mind, kind of size the shark for us, if you will. How big a deal is Vineyard Wind for Massachusetts and the country?
It's, I can't really overstate how big a deal it is, to be honest. It is the first utility scale offshore wind project. All eyes are on it. Once it's up and running, it will power about 400,000 homes in the Commonwealth, which is about one in six. So it's a really big deal, and it sets a big precedent. I should say that quick on its heels is the Mayflower Wind Project, and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts has recently released a RFP or a solicitation for the third offshore wind project, which is going to be double the size of Vineyard Wind.
All right, you heard me ask Annie Ropeek about the commercial fishing industry. You know, Maine did this ban of offshore wind projects from state waters to help mitigate those sort of effects. And that was with a governor who is actually pro-offshore wind. How is Massachusetts thinking about other ocean users, including commercial fishing?
It's a good question and a really important one. You know, the League of Massachusetts and the New England for Offshore Wind Coalition, which we lead, believe strongly that responsibly developed offshore wind can coexist with the many other ocean uses that we value. But Annie is right that the devil is in the details, and having a robust stakeholder process is fundamental to the responsible build out of this industry.
And how does that work?
Well, I think starting from the very beginning, you know, the offshore wind development process takes many years, starting with the Bureau of Oceans and Energy Management carving out lease areas, which is a stakeholder intensive process, and then convening community members and other stakeholder groups, fisheries associations, to understand how those areas are being used.
So, Elizabeth,
to be a lot of conversation. Go ahead.
We have a little bit of a lag again. Sorry about that. You know, I'm thinking about this 62 number, turbines. There has to be an environmental impact to building that, these massive structures in an ecosystem. In its approval, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, acknowledges that there's a chance the project could harm marine life. Talk about the trade-offs.
Well, you know, all energy sources, there is no energy source that is without impact. And that calls upon all of us to be conservative with how we use energy, to be thoughtful and efficient, and value energy efficiency. That said, I think utility scale offshore wind, particularly outside of state waters in these further, in the federal waters that are further from our coasts, are less likely to interfere with avian flyways, have less marine and fisheries traffic, and can be and construction can be managed in a way to allow for critically endangered species, for example, like the North Atlantic right whale, to pass through during their seasonal migration without interference. So they are, I'm not trying to pretend that there are no impacts, but I do think that particularly relative to almost any other renewable energy resource, and particularly compared to fossil fuels, there's a lot to like about offshore wind.
So let's talk about a potential different impact. There are those saying that this is a new industry and a big one, and as such could actually be used as a way to address the racial wealth gap. I know the Environmental League recently hosted a Zoom event in May connecting four offshore wind developers with advocates and business organizations pushing the industry to do that. Where do you see that potential, and what requirements should be in place for future projects to help bring it to fruition?
It's a great question. The Environmental League and our many advocacy partners have been calling for economic inclusion and environmental justice to be key considerations in the evaluation of offshore wind bids. And that's because, as Annie mentioned, offshore wind is projected to be the workhorse of New England's clean energy transition. Although estimates vary, we may see across the six New England states the demand for upwards of 50 gigawatts of offshore wind, which represents about $100 billion in direct capital investment across the six New England states over the next couple of decades. Less than 10% of the offshore wind that New England needs has been procured, and construction has barely begun. So imagine that nearly everyone who will be hired in the offshore wind industry has not been hired yet. And so I think the time is right to ask the question of who gets these jobs, who gets these contracts and subcontracts. And it is my view that offshore wind will be one of the single largest sources of economic development, of economic activity in New England over the next generation. And so ELM is focused on making changes to the state's procurement policy for offshore wind. We're not looking for quotas or targets per se, but we would like the state to put sufficient weight on economic inclusion and environmental justice in the solicitation process. Essentially, it's putting enough points so that developers pay attention, so that they compete on this dimension. You can imagine how powerful it would be if developers and the private sector brought all of their creativity and expertise and resource and truly competed on the basis of economic inclusion.
All right. That is Elizabeth Turnbull-Henry, president of the Environmental League of Massachusetts. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us.